Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Beginning our afternoon, so we will. I'll give a bit of a reflection. We'll look at a sutta, and then again sitting and walking. And we can come back at 4:30 Eastern time, and if there's any discussion that wants to happen, we can do it then. But kind of gauging how much discussion there was, so we'll just see what comes up through the afternoon's practice and looking at the next sutta. Like I said, nutriment is, it's kind of hard to figure out how to integrate it into our practice, right? It's intriguing, it's curious, it seems to make sense. The Buddha said, actually, in the Book of Ones, but also there's a teaching directed for novices where they say, what is one? One is the reality that all beings subsist on nutriment. This is considered to be a basic fundamental truth. If there is a being, it is dependent on a fuel source, a nutriment. It comes from a source. Not beings aren't dependent on anything, but beings are dependent on stuff. Yeah, and so that dependency is what links them to nutriment. And there are even some beings that arise from their nutriment. There's a whole class of beings. You think of like bacteria or molds or algae, stuff like that, that are just basically going to start to arise and show up. I think in the Indian cosmology, like fruit flies just come from fruit. they're just born from rotting fruit. You leave rotting fruit and fruit flies appear exists to them. The idea of it being colonized by bigger flies didn't make any sense at all. Like every piece of fruit you ever saw in ancient India produced fruit flies almost immediately. So they said it must be the fruit that is giving birth to the flies. Yeah. Well, we've pierced that illusion with, intense study in modern science. Still, there's the reality of nutriment is just a fundamental fact of our reality. Yeah. So it's hard to kind of figure out when the Buddha says it's actually a problem. Like, well, you can't live without it, right? I think I'm a being. Therefore, I am dependent on nutriment. What do I do? But this is where we start to divide things, and we start to say, well, there's a lot of your being that is exists because of previous conditions. You've been born, so your body is here, and your body is living kind of independent to some degree of the choices that you make. And thank goodness you don't have to think, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. You don't, when you swallow something, you don't have to think down, down, no, keep down. Keep going, keep going. You don't have to will your food to go through your digestive tract. Your body just knows what to do because it is a living organism. But it is not a satta, it is not a being, it is not deterministic. Your body doesn't generate karma. Yeah, that is something that a mind does. It is the mind, the consciousness deriving from ignorance and volition. That is what we call a satta. And that's kind of the difference between you and me and a plant. Plants don't suffer because they don't make decisions. If there's a light source, if there's a source of nutriment, they're just growing towards those. You cut off a limb, they try and grow it back, or they grow a different one, they just keep doing what they do. They're not making choices or suffering over their choices. That's something for beings, sattas, to do. Yeah. And that's where you start to connect the idea of being a being and suffering. Only beings suffer. So what is the condition for suffering existing? What is the condition for not suffering? Well, If I didn't exist, I wouldn't suffer, right? What do we do? What do we do? It doesn't sound feasible, right? But then again, something that we start to grasp progressively, and especially this is why nutrients make a lot more sense as you get later in the path, into deep stages of samadhi, you start to see parts of the mind that you thought were always there cease. First, it's the hindrances. They cease. It's not that they go left or they go right or they go up or down. They're not hiding under your bed. They are gone. They were dependent on a source. You removed that source and they cease. They are nowhere to be found. And then applied and sustained thought, something that is a basic fundamental part of us thinking, right? Ceases. And our mind, through samadhi, our mind is willing to stay with an object and it doesn't wander. Because the part of the mind that could wander has ceased. Again, if we talk about it, it's just talk. If you've seen it, then it's something totally different. Experientially, it's something amazing. It's a profound world-shattering insight. Wait, that little voice, it can cease without remainder. The action of applying my mind to something or drifting off, that can cease. My mind can stay with an object attached completely through unceasing interest and joy with that object. How could this be? Yeah. But again, through samadhi, you start to see that things can cease. They can end. They're not necessary. The final meditative attainments, the eighth jhana, if you number the jhanas, will be the cessation of perception and feeling. Now these are so essential. It's kind of considered that if you are conscious of something, you are perceiving and feeling. You are trying to figure out what it is you're conscious of, and you're deciding if you like it or not. And if instantaneously. Right? If you were to, you can't not do it. Is that something you can consciously stop doing? You're like, I'm not going to do perception. Yeah, it leads to suffering. I'm just going to be just consciousness. That actually wouldn't be, it really wouldn't be existing, right? To a greater degree. There is a class of beings in the Buddhist cosmology called those who are not percipient. And is a very, very specialized class of beings who, through meditative attainment, were able to achieve a state where perception does not arise. But they are also called like the great unconscious ones or something, because they are literally asleep. For trillions of years, they sleep, unable to perceive the things that are happening. The objects that are floating through their mind, unable to feel about it one way or another. It's kind of a great cosmic joke in a way. That's not enlightenment. It's not anything. It's not functional. They wake up after trillions of years and they go back to suffering. They haven't done anything to remove the causes of suffering. They just took a vacation from it. For a couple trillion years, and it comes back with a vengeance as soon as they stop. So that's not that useful, but nevertheless, there's this meditative attainment where perception and feeling cease, and there's just consciousness, just pure consciousness without any of the other structure of the mind arising. And then this is where one would shift over to the fruit of non-returning. Yeah. There can be a cessation of consciousness itself. And again, it's just talk. We just talk about that. Like, yeah, I mean, it's just, why bother describing it? Yeah. But if you were to experience that, then you would have, beyond any shadow of a doubt, you would have experiential knowledge that consciousness is not everything. That there are other ways for dhammas, things, to exist without you having to have consciousness perceive them. that dhammas can arise and cease, that there can be a whole universe of a whole multiverse of existences without you having to be conscious of them and perceiving them and deciding if you like them or not. And this is where the Buddha talks about the Nibbana element. The Nibbana element doesn't arise, doesn't cease. Everything that arises and ceases is within the Nibbana element. But the Nibbana element is not added to or subtracted from because of it. But this means that consciousness is just another Dhamma. This means that existence is just another thing that's happening. How do you reach a state where you're willing to look at the actually existing as just another thing? It's just another thing in a universe full of things. And it's not even that big a deal. And you become totally okay. If it's going to cease someday, it'll cease. And we don't need to worry about it starting back up again. Now, in order to pursue that, because what you're pursuing then is full enlightenment. You're pursuing being okay with existence ending. It's not that you need to make existence ending, and it's not that your existence will end because you attain that. All that you have attained is the cessation of all suffering, all clinging to existence. And it turns out existence is just like your body. It knows what to do. It'll do its stuff, it'll live out its time, and when it ends, and nobody needs to suffer over that. And you don't need to put in the causes and conditions for more existence. You don't need to worry about it. Why worry about it? Just relax. And that's the later stages of the path. You realize that would actually be quite nice. Not non-existence, because again, it's very hard for the mind, which is focused on existence, to conceive of that in any way, shape, or form, but focusing on the not suffering part. What if I just related to consciousness, to sankharas, to perceptions and feelings as just other things and saw them arising and ceasing, and it didn't bother me at all? Well, then the talk about nutriments would make sense. You'd say, wow, we just have to remove some basic causes and conditions, and the suffering would cease. All of the mental habits that are causing that suffering would cease. They would end, and they would end without remainder. They would end in a way that they don't have anything to come back to. And that's, yeah. So we took that to, this is kind of how very deep practitioners are thinking in the later stages of the path. They're seeing themselves and they're saying, that's why I suffer. You. Why don't we do something about you? Without you, there won't be any suffering. And they're willing to they're really willing to investigate and to the thing about it is they're willing to make changes. And so if you're wondering, like, how do I even apply this? The fact of the matter is the reason this isn't really taught to lay people is because in order to understand it and apply it at all, you have to be willing to make drastic lifestyle changes to see what happens. You need to be able to stop eating dinner. You need to be able to stop watching movies. You need to be able to sit in meditation all through the night and get up the next morning and just go do your work just like normal. You need to be able to look at the things that you think are intrinsically you and say, well, that's exactly what I should avoid. Remember talking with Ajahn Jayanto, a monk who's now the abbot of Temple Forest Monastery in New Hampshire. And he was offered the position, I guess you could call it, of founding a monastery in the Northeast US years before he accepted. His parents were part of a group that got together and invited the Ajahn Chah Sangha to start a monastery. And he was from that area, and his parents were, they were on the board. And so it's just obvious, like, yeah, come start a monastery. And he didn't wanna. He put it off for years and years, and he stayed a student of Ajahn Suchito, and they would travel the world, and they'd do retreats, and they'd be back at the monastery, and he'd train monks and all of that. And then finally one day he accepted. And it came, and they bought a property, and it just like instant monastery, yeah, because people have been waiting for so long. They were just ready to go. And it was interesting. I got to talk with him in those early years, and he said, I wondered what had changed. And he said, well, actually, at some point he felt ready, and he felt like he wanted to investigate what it would be like to be so close to the things that had been important to him growing up. Yeah. And I realized that to some degree, when he was in his early training, and this is for many monastics, you look at things that you used to do and you say, well, that led to suffering. I don't know about all this other stuff, the wearing the robes and the bowls and stuff. The jury's out on whether or not that's all suffering. But I know growing up, I was suffering a lot. So the places, the foods, the activities, the whole culture wasn't working. You know, so based on my experience, I should just avoid that. Yeah. It's very interesting. You kind of have to get seclusion from it. You kind of have to step away from it to see it as it really is. And then someday you come back and maybe you're ready. And you're like, I'm ready to see if I can be near these things and not fall into the same pits of suffering. Yeah. Which is, yeah, is a kind of is a very brave thing, but it's also at the point where you want the challenge. Yeah, you don't want to come back so that you can keep going back to all of the things that you really liked. You're coming back so that you can finally see it as it really is and overcome it as a kind of last act of planting your flag and saying, no, I am done with you. No more existence like this for me. Yeah. And this is what you kind of do when you recognize something is causing your suffering, or that your suffering is dependent on something. Are you willing to actually remove that thing? And many of us will say, well, yeah, next lifetime, I guarantee I'll do it next lifetime. And that's fine. That's not even not Buddhist. That's just like there's nothing wrong with that. It's not the most, you know, Uju is not the most energetic way of approaching practice, but I mean, it can work. Yeah. But if you are interested in the practice, this is one of those things. So that's enough preamble. Let's just talk about the Baby Jerky Sutta. Let's, okay, so this is Samyutta Nikaya 1263. So it's the sutta right before the one we covered this morning. And you can all see it. See good? Yeah. Okay, so this sutta is called the Puttamansa Sutta, which literally means flesh of the sun. Yeah. Affectionately called the Baby Jerky Sutta by young monastics these days. Okay, and so at Sawati, the Buddha says, monks, there are these four nutriments. They maintain sentient beings that have been born and help those that are about to be born. What for? Solid food, whether solid or subtle. Contact is second. Mental intention is third. Consciousness as the fourth. These are the four nutriments. And how should you regard the nutriment of solid food? Suppose a couple who were husband and wife set out to cross a desert, taking limited supplies. They had an only child with them, dear and beloved. As the couple were crossing the desert, their limited quantity of supplies would run out, and they'd still have the rest of the desert to cross. Then it would occur to that couple, why don't we kill our only child, so dear and beloved, and prepare dried and spiced meat? Then we can make it across the desert by eating our child's flesh. Let not all three of us perish. Then that couple would kill their only child, so dear and beloved, and prepare dried and spiced meat, They'd make it across the desert by eating their child's flesh. And as they'd eat their child's flesh, they'd beat their breasts and cry, "Where are you, our only child? Where are you?" What do you think, monks? Would they eat that food for fun, indulgence, adornment, or decoration? No, venerable sir. Wouldn't they eat that food just so they could make it across the desert? Yes, venerable sir. I say this is how you should regard solid food. When solid food is completely understood, desire for the five kinds of sensual stimulation is completely understood. When desire for the five kinds of sensual stimulation is completely understood, the noble disciple is bound by no fetter and might return them again to this world. Okay. So, man, those were the days, huh? When you could go on a road trip and you take your children with you, not because you enjoyed their company, but because just in case your car broke down, you would have a snack while you were waiting for the tow truck. Yeah. But it, as obscene a sutta as it is, it's meant to convey something that is, again, is particular to how monastics are given the freedom based on their renunciant lifestyle to consider things, right? Most people don't really have the luxury of considering food as a hindrance. Most people are really into food, to be quite honest. But if you're a monastic, you get to see the downsides of food. Yeah. And it's not just the gathering of the food or the preparing of the food or the eating of the food or the cleaning up of the dishes. It's all of those things. Every single meal entails all of these steps. Yeah. But furthermore, on a kind of greater like degree, the food is destroyed by this process. Yeah. You have a shiny, juicy red apple, but in order to consume that as food, because you can't just like rub it on your head without harming it and somehow get the nutrition, you have to chew it, crunch it, you know, cover it in saliva, swallow it, digest it in order to get any nutrient from it. That completely destroys it. It turns it from a bright red, juicy, shiny apple into feces through a time-honored process. Yeah. So it's anything that you consume in this way will be destroyed and lost forever. Do you relate that way to your food? I mean, no, mostly we're so excited about it. It looks so good, yeah. The moment it is passed into the mouth, though, we want to stop thinking about it. Yeah. It stops being food and it starts being just a like good old full belly, pit of Sukha Vedana, pleasant feeling, right? It has already changed from food out there to me in here. So this is offering a way of relating to food as a necessity, but a sort of like desperate necessity, right? You kind of have to eat. You're crossing a desert, and this is the nature of being a human being, is you kind of have to eat constantly, like every day. You have to eat something in order to survive. Yeah. And so it's like you're on a dangerous, perilous journey. And if there wasn't a practice, then, you know, whether you live or die is not such a big deal. But because one more day of surviving might give you one more opportunity, one more day's opportunity to practice the Eightfold Path, then this necessity makes sense. Yeah. You're eating just to get through the next day and have that much more opportunity to understand the Buddha's teaching and to get to the end of suffering. So, yeah, it's not that monks look at every piece of bacon that might come their way into their alms bowl and say, "This is just like the flesh of my only son." No, we say, "This is bacon. It was somebody's flesh." But this is not for fun, not for pleasure, not for adornment. not for beautification of the body. This is just to get through the day. And when they have enough to do that, they just set the rest aside. Yeah. What other compulsion could they get? The Buddha says, very interestingly, there at the end, that to fully understand this means there is no fetter by which one could be reborn in this world. Which is, he's saying, to fully understand the nature of physical food is to attain non-returning. Yeah. You could still be reborn, but you'd be reborn in the non-returner world, meaning you would have no form. You'd be a formless being, or a being that could take form at will and disregard it equally at will. And that is because to understand physical food is to understand that you are not eating anything. The body eats, the mind cannot. Yeah. And so any mental state that arises that says, I am hungry, I need to eat, I am eating, I have been nourished, I'm going to get through another, all of those, they're missing the point. It's the body doing those things, not the mind. And once you get that, it's, well, again, it's hard to, it's just talk to talk about it. But once you get it, you get it. And the body is just the body. It's just the body doing those things. And at that point, the mind sees the body as all other forms are basically the same. You know, the only reason the non-returner continues to live out their days, taking care of themselves is because, yeah, its consciousness is still arising and it's arising here. It doesn't stop being located at this body because they've gotten over that layer of suffering. Their consciousness is arising dependent on this body because of the condition of birth. And when you die, then that condition will cease. No problem. It fixes itself. Let us go onward to our second nutriment. Okay. And how should you regard contact, sense contact, as fuel? Suppose there was a flayed cow, and that being a cow that's had its skin removed for some reason. Maybe they did this in India. Maybe it was for the leather or something. I don't know why they would do that. But if that cow were to stand by a wall, the creatures on the wall, like ants, would bite her. If she were to stand under a tree, the creatures in the tree would bite her. If she stands in some water, the creatures in the water would bite her. If she stands out in the open, the creatures in the open would bite her. So, like flies. Wherever that flayed cow would stand, the creatures there would bite her. I say this is how you should regard contact as fuel. When contact, as a nutriment is completely understood, the three feelings, Vedana, are completely understood. When the three feelings are completely understood, a noble disciple has nothing further to do, I say. A powerful statement. So this is where the next three nutriments, the Buddha is basically saying to actually comprehend this is to attain full enlightenment. There is nothing more to be done. And that is because these last three nutriments are they're the basic conditions, they're conditioning the mind itself directly, right? And so our most subtle fetters will be associated with these. But what is contact, sense contact? Well, there is the eye, and there are visible objects, the pen. It shows up in all the Dhamma talks. And when the visible object meets the eye, there is the arising of eye consciousness. This meeting of the two we call contact. Yeah. So contact is dependent on two things. It's on the object and on the sense base. And contact causes the two. Now, if contact does not occur, then the consciousness does not occur. If the consciousness does not occur, then the feeling can't occur. So what is the nutriment? Well, we find that in our daily life, we're all, has anyone ever, like, you've been trying to meditate and somebody's got a TV on somewhere nearby? What does that feel like, right? It's awful, isn't it? You're trying to keep the mind steady and focused and to be in the present moment. And somebody, anything. It could be a car commercial. It could be the news. It could be Sesame Street. But every single sound seems to just smack into your sense base and just grab you, wrench you away from your peace. And it's like you have no control whatsoever. Well, we've been conditioned by years of media to regard those as attractive objects. They actually work very hard to make everything, every second that is put out in on a television to be attention grabbing. Yeah. And so it's not really our fault. But knowing that, suppose you were to avoid televisions, you were to say that if I were to get close to that, then my mind would be crawling as though it had ants all over it. Yeah, I would have no control over that. That icky feeling of, just restlessness would be conditioned by the contact, by the proximity. Right? If we were hungry, we would probably not want to go and sit down next to McDonald's where they're kind of venting all of their burger grease and French fry grease and all of these wonderful smells. They're actually allowed by law to vent that into the air so that they could kind of draw people in. Yeah. That would not be a good place to sit. That would it would if that increased our hunger, it would kind of be our own fault for being there, right? But to an even greater degree, recognizing that if there is contact, there is going to be feeling, yeah, our sense base is necessary. At the entry to samadhi, the first jhana, the sense bases have gone quiet. They're not relevant. The mind is internally composed and focused on an object independent of the five senses. Right? And this is where we can get an experience of not having the sense bases. And wow, is that more peaceful? That is just so much better. It turns out you can actually have experience that is not coming through the five senses. And when you do it that way, there's a lot of suffering that does not occur. And also, there is not compulsion. Because the compulsion is coming from this meeting of objects that is really independent of you. And so, to understand this and to lose all interest and infatuation with the sense bases themselves, to have no possession over them, to see them as they're just phenomena, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body. It's just a sphere of activity. It's not me. It's just like a TV screen that I don't want to draw too close to. You would attain a layer of permanent seclusion from these things. You'd be like, yeah, okay. When I really need to, I'll look at the TV screen and figure out what's going on. But if I don't need to, I just hang back. It's just a lot of dukkha. And that would be understanding this nutriment. Yeah, there's so many defilements need that contact to continue to grow and to multiply. And how should you regard mental intention or manosanjetana as a nutriment? Suppose there is a pit of glowing coals deeper than a man's height, filled with glowing coals that neither flamed nor smoked. Then a person could come along who wants to live and doesn't want to die, who wants to be happy and recoils from pain. That's basically, that's everybody. Two strong men would grab him by the arms and drag them towards a pit of glowing coals. Then that person's intention, aim, and wish would be to get far away. Why is that? Because that person would think, if I fall into that pit of glowing coals, this will result in my death or deadly pain. I say that this is how you should regard mental intention as fuel. When mental intention as fuel is completely understood, the three cravings are completely understood. When the three cravings are completely understood, a noble disciple has nothing further to do, I say. So we talked about manosanjetana this morning. The idea of mental volition. And it is this part of the mind that is looking at an experience And from that, it's deciding it wants to have other experiences. Yeah. So say we see the red apple and we suspect that there's a crisp, juicy, sweet experience to be had. And so the sight of the apple draws us into thinking about cutting it and juicing it and chewing it and savoring it, right? All of these activities derive from that, the drawing close to that one object. Yeah. Or we see a couch and we think, oh, it's been such a long day. If we were wise and mindful, we would say, the moment I sit down on that couch, all of these mental activities are going to come flooding in. I'm gonna want to kick back. I'm gonna want to procrastinate on all the duties I still have left to do today. I'm gonna want to have a snack. I'm gonna want to watch something on my phone. All of these things are going to happen based on a couch. And by the way, I don't have a couch. You're just asking for it, right? That's what that is for, right? But this is how you could start to look at these central points of habit energy, right? And I say in a monastery, the place where the monks eat is not a place where they gather and hang out and read suttas, right? That is the place for eating. And when you go to eat, you're bombarded with all kinds of different sense contacts. And there's dishes and there's smells and there's people coming and going. You go there when you have to. Yeah, but it is like standing at the edge of a volcano. You will walk around the rim of the volcano as though you're on a precarious cliff, and you will leave as soon as you can, because there's so many things that could just snare you and lead you off into all sorts of different mental states. Yeah. How many habits do we have that we relate to them this way? Now, if you've ever dealt with an addiction, you might understand this much better. If you're an alcoholic, then you probably had to learn through hard experience that you needed to make a lifestyle change, and that you cannot be an alcoholic and go hang out at a bar. It just doesn't work that way. You have to avoid the bars and the clubs and the places where alcohol is sold and everybody is drinking, because that is one of the things that connects and emboldens all of the mental activities that you are trying to overcome. And if you are a smoker, then you probably don't, if you're trying to quit smoking, you probably don't go hang out in the smoking area. Do they still have those? Things have changed a lot over the years, but they must have like a smoking area, like an airport or something, right? I don't even know. But if you were to hang out there just for fun when you're trying to quit smoking, that would make no sense, right? It would encourage and give nutriment to all of your thoughts associated with smoking, whereas that's something you're trying to overcome. If you're dieting and you're trying to lose weight, you would really be very careful about how you relate to your refrigerator. Even to the point that you would, wrap a chain around the handle and just like try to slow any approach you would have to that object. You would begin to look at it as though it were a pit of glowing coals, a source of danger. And this is exactly what the Buddha is suggesting. Yeah, because once you get too close to that, it just starts working on its own. And that's the nature of volition. It's not that all of those volitions, the urge to drink, the urge to smoke, the urge to eat, are coming out of nowhere. You chose them through the choosing of an activity that's proximate, that's close, and is connected to those activities. Yeah. Those are very, those are serious examples where somebody feels really motivated to make a change and they realize they have to really change their lifestyle in order to be successful. But that's a good example. That's why it's a good example. Many of the things that cause us suffering cause us low-level suffering. And when we're close to that source of suffering, we tend to tell ourselves, it's really not that bad. Or maybe this time it won't be that bad. even though every other time it has been bad, we'd say it's a low level suffering. I can tolerate it. I'll just dip my toe in and then I'll get back out. It'll be fine. Yeah, it'll be fine. Would you dip your toe into a glowing red hot pit of coals? Would even one toe's worth be tolerable? It would be a really bad idea, right? And this is how we would start to say, wow, I know that this is going to be suffering. What if I don't even toy with it? What if I don't even get close to it? And finally, we have the nutriment of consciousness. How should you regard consciousness as a nutriment? Suppose they were to arrest a bandit, a criminal, and present them to the king, saying, "Your Majesty, this is a bandit, a criminal. Punish him as you like." The king would say, "Go, my men, and strike this man in the morning with 100 spears." And the king's men would do as they were told. Then at midday, the king would say, "Well, how is it? How's that man?" And they would say, "Well, he's still alive, Your Majesty." So the king would say, "Well, go and strike the man in the middle of the day with 100 spears." The men would do as they were told, and then in the late afternoon, the king would say, "So, how is he?" "He's still alive, Your Majesty." And the king would say, "Go, my men, and strike this man in the late afternoon with 100 spears." And the king's men would do as they were told. What do you think, mendicants? Would that man experience pain and distress from being struck with 300 spears each day? Yes, venerable sir, that man would experience pain and distress from being struck with 1 spear, let alone 300 spears. I say that is how you should regard consciousness as a nutriment. When consciousness as a nutriment is completely understood, name and form is completely understood. When name and form are completely understood, a noble disciple has nothing further to do, I say. Is the sutta. And we talked about this, I don't know if it was last Wednesday or the Wednesday before, but a very peculiar notion, yeah, seeing that consciousness is seemingly essential, seemingly neutral, right? It's just being aware of stuff, is actually the cause of our suffering. If we weren't conscious, we wouldn't suffer. Yeah. And it's, I mean, when you put it that way, it seems really weird. It's obvious, it's true, and yet at the same time, what can we do about it? But what do we tell ourselves about consciousness? Do we tell ourselves, "Well, I can't not be conscious, so we just got to leave that one alone." Yeah. Maybe someone somewhere is able to attain some level of samadhi where they can get away from consciousness, but I can't. So I'm gonna do all the other stuff, and we'll get to that one later. But what's being suggested is not overarching consciousness all as itself, but looking at what kind of consciousness, what kind of experience is totally suffering, is totally painful, is totally unpleasant, and do we nonetheless set ourselves up for it? Yeah. Again, looking at something like a pain in the knee, you know, if we keep asking ourselves, "Oh, my knee hurts. Oh, my knee hurts," you know, somebody says, "Oh, do you want to go for a walk?" We're like, "Oh, my knee hurts," and that gets us thinking about it. Oh, it's just, now I'm thinking about how much my knee hurts. You know, all of this is all of the pain, all the prevarication, all of the avoiding of activities, all of the cringing away from things that might make it worse, all of these are dependent on the awareness of that pain in the knee. But when we're not thinking about the knee, we're not thinking about the pain in the knee. At that point in time, the consciousness, the knee consciousness, is not arising. And so, dependent on that, the pain is not arising. Dependent on that, all of those mental states are not arising. To understand this is to understand everything that we tell ourselves is us, is an important component of us, is an unavoidable component of us. And to realize that there is no us, that whatever we are in any given moment is just whatever components are present in that moment, and that not all of them are. When we're not thinking about our knee, to some degree, it doesn't exist in the mind. It exists in the body, but then we are not the body. And the body is bound by physical laws and it continues to move on. It's what the Buddha calls old kamma. Yeah. The body is a byproduct. We don't have to generate it every moment. But what goes on in the mind is very moment to moment because consciousness only lasts a moment. Yeah. And that really, then it matters what you're paying attention to and why you're paying attention to So, I mean, one example that just occurs to me that seems pretty obvious is social media, and this is something that can actually work for all the other nutrients because there's so many ways that it causes suffering. But if you notice that every time you enter social media, you feel intense emotion, whether pleasant or painful or exceedingly neutral, like very, very bored, disinterested, turned off by what you read very quickly, then, well, you could tell yourself that it's necessary that you do this, but why would you do that? Why would you tell yourself that this experience is necessary? If you were to relate to that experience like getting stabbed with a spear, then you would avoid Twitter, you would avoid Facebook, you would avoid all of these social medias as though, it was somebody trying to stab you. Somebody is saying, "Oh, did you hear what it was like?" No, why would I do that? Why would I look into that? It would hurt. And very necessarily, certain social groups you would no longer be a part of. But if those social groups were based on and founded on suffering, maybe that would be a good thing. And again, this is a voluntary choice, a voluntary exploration. Nobody can tell you like, "No, you've got to stop doing that thing." Even if somebody forced you to stop doing that, if you didn't come to the understanding that it was suffering, then the desire for it would still remain. And as in the sutta this morning, is the desire that leads you towards these nutriments, that draws you close to them. The desire is the reason you incline towards them at all in order to get stuck. Or in this case, struck. Yeah. You get too close to the thing and you get stabbed. So just give it up. Give up that experience. And maybe just like consciousnesses still arise. Maybe every once in a while you are aware of the knee. Maybe every once in a while you do hear something about what somebody said on social media. Maybe every now and then you do catch a piece of news that is distressing, but you didn't seek it out. You didn't desire it. You just receive it. It arises. You feel it, and then it goes its own way. There's no nutriment. There's no dwelling on it. There's no building an identity around it. So it has nothing to survive on. There's no fuel. There's no binding agent to keep it in your mind, and it just slides right back out. And that would be. It wouldn't immediately remove the suffering of that experience, but it re would remove the cause of any future suffering from that. It would remove the continuity of suffering, such as, is what samsara is. It's not just that it's unpleasant in the moment, it's that it continues to be unpleasant, and we've got these conditions that keep us in the middle of it over and over and over and over and over. Okay, so that's some basis for this. If we come back at 4:30 and you have any questions, bring them up then. This is very kind of out there, but maybe it really gets the mind thinking, and maybe you've even come to some conclusions about how you could use this that I haven't, which would be great. I'd love to hear it. So we'll sit and walk on the half hours, and then if you're still around at 4:30 Eastern time, then we'll chat then.